Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Rachel Halliburton, and with me today to talk about Honeymoon Suite are Carol Waddis, Jane Edwards, Patrick Marmion and David Benedict. In a recent interview, the playwright Richard Bean denounced plays about nothing but relationships. He proclaimed, "If it's a play about somebody's private experience, or someone's personal problem, or a family that is a bit dysfunctional, I shrug my shoulders and say, so what? Since September 11th, we have to stop writing plays about people's little personal problems." So it is somewhat intriguing to discover that Honeymoon Suite, his latest play, is also the most intensely personal work of a writer who has created dramas from such diverse subjects as working in a Hull bread plant and surviving in the Third World with irreverent foreign aid workers. The Honeymoon Suite of the title is set in Bridlington, and it quickly becomes clear that for the couple staying there, affairs have gone from sweet to sour. Bean's main device, which smacks more than a little of Alan Ayckbourn, is to show the same couple at three different stages in their relationship. Three pairs of actors take on each of the different points in the couple's life, from fresh honeymoon optimism to middle-aged disillusionment and finally elderly reconciliation. What is schematically interesting is the way that Bean allows the younger and older couples to inhabit the stage at the same time, giving a sense of a room filled with memories and ghosts. Both Eddie and Irene want to escape their working class origins, but where she sees education as the way out, he's simply looking for the next dodgy deal. Gradually we see how social forces will eventually become a more potent weapon than any Cupid's arrow that initially bound them together. Patrick, Richard Bean has enjoyed considerable critical success, not least with Under the Whaleback and The God Botherers. Do you think this is among the best of his crop?
No, for my money, it was the least of the three, actually. And for me, there was the big problem, I think, was that the stage was just quite simply too crowded a lot of the time. And I know there's this cool and clever device about having all these people on stage the whole time, but sometimes they were just literally getting in the way of each other. And if they weren't getting in the way of each other, they were getting in the way of my enjoyment of the play.
David, was it a highlight for you?
No, I was very disappointed by this. I'm probably the only member of the theatre community that's yet to have seen a Richard Bean play until now, missed them unaccountably. So I went with quite high expectations, but after an initial enjoyment of the device, when the play sagged for me, as it did badly for at least half an hour, I sat there making a list of other plays I'd seen that did this device better, like Carol Church's Hotel, several J.B. Priestley plays, several Alan Ayckbourn plays, even, God forbid, almost Yasmina Reza's Lifetimes 3.
Jane, did you find your mind venturing elsewhere?
Well, I'm usually a sucker for plays. I mean, this is essentially a play about time, about past dreams and present reality, and I'm usually gulping away in the stalls doing those, but here I felt very unengaged by the people, and as David said, really just admired the device without really getting involved in it.
Carol, I believe it might have gone down slightly better with you.
I'm afraid I absolutely loved it. I am beginning to think that there is a northern-southern little thing going on here, because what I enjoyed most of all about this was the northern humour, which I know is a crass kind of thing to say, but I loved the humour. I was drawn along very much by the characters and by the poignancy of seeing the hopes of a young couple and how that metamorphosed into the disillusionment of the older couple. I would grant that there were some problems between the transition between, for example, the middle-aged character and the third character. How did he suddenly become this rather bumptious entrepreneur into the older Eddie, who is contemplating the idea of suicide? But even so, I found it incredibly poignant.
I too found it quite difficult to actually work out how the transition had happened between the middle-aged character and, as you were saying, the middle-aged persona of the husband, who starts out as Eddie and is known as Tits. He then graduates to this kind of meditating hippie, obviously because there's nothing else he can really find to do with his life. And, you know, going from the kind of man who is simply into scamming and wasn't interested in reading or personal exploration of any kind to end up going down the path of meditation rather than perhaps the route of alcohol, or, you know, I just couldn't quite countenance that. I mean, Patrick, would you disagree?
Not especially. I mean, I think you've got to remember this is a Richard Bean play, and anything can and does happen in a Richard Bean play, and this is one of the things that I love about him. And I think that that Carol it was absolutely right saying that its greatest asset is, of course, its humour. And when any play which contains a joke referring to a manic depressive as being up and down like a wanker's elbow is certainly worth the admission money. The problem is whether it redoes anything else, and I don't feel it does, actually.
I mean, I agree. I mean, I in fact wrote down that self-same line, but I sat there thinking, yes, but it's not funny enough. I mean, it's odious to draw comparisons, but I'm going to do it. Alan Ayckbourn's Absurd Person Singular, which takes place on three Christmas Eves and charts a similar sort of upheaval in the lives of the characters, manages to be deeply upsetting and incredibly funny. I mean, the laughter is really disturbing in that play, because you're going, no, but this situation is painful. Yes, but it's funny. This, I think, strives for something of that, but actually falls short. And the device of them overhearing each other at different points in their life is really interesting to begin with, but ultimately the play, for me, is it fails to work because that device doesn't move on. You basically get the idea of people... We see them overseeing different stages of their lives. But there's no action in the writing. There aren't events that move things on. The events have happened in between those time periods, and they merely reflect upon it, which makes watching it a very inert experience.
And I have to say, as a result of that inertness, I felt that the humour, which has definitely been a high point in his other plays, actually was a handicap here, because it felt as if those one-liners, which he... In The Gold Botherers, which was his play about foreign aid workers, I was falling around every five minutes.
I hated that. I thought every line in that play at the Bush,
yes,
was sacrificed. Every funny line was actually sacrificed to the story. I hated that.
Yes,
but it's very contrived, this play, because the jokes, as you say, the jokes are good jokes, but they often don't come in the right places. The struggle to set it in the hotel, to make sense of having it three times in that same hotel room, is pretty stretched. And as David says, he doesn't join up the dots between the characters at the different stages of their lives. How on earth does that woman, that unconfident girl, become Mo Molum of Northern Ireland? You know, I mean, it is just incredible.
Well, I think I got an explanation of that, actually, and I think that I wouldn't actually call this play misogynistic, but I think that'd be far too harsh. But it is at least rigged against the women, and I think the men are much the most colourful parts.
I would say that
particularly the women, there is a sort of what the first one is kind of frigid and weak, really, and the second one is sexually betraying and largely silent, and the final twist and insult is, of course, that the last is a successful civil servant in Brussels. You know, what could be more damning than that?
Patrick, I'd have to take issue with you. I found that the first woman was so perfectly in tune for a 1950s virgin. As a child of the 1950s, I can tell you that was pretty I was pretty spot on, actually. And I did feel that in her second incarnation, I had great sympathy for her. I felt that second the female character the second time around was very underwritten, terribly underwritten, and I felt that the actress had the hardest job, actually.
But then he has described it as Romeo and Juliet, and what happens to Romeo and Juliet if they survive the end of Shakespeare's play, and there is no way that first couple have any of the intensity of passion and feeling that would then carry you through this play, that again it's a kind of ambles too much and is too lacking in passion, really.
It seems to me that it gets very sentimental, actually, that particularly in the underwriting, as Carol rightly says, of the second stage of the woman's development, because that's so vague, because we can't see how she got to that position and how she gets out of it, you have to take a lot of stuff as read, which actually isn't there. It's sort of sentimentalizing, and you go, oh, I see her journey. Well, you don't. Actually, what you're doing is you're supplying the journey. That.
And Patrick, sort of building more on what you were saying, Richard Bean, after all, has achieved most of his success by writing about closed male communities, by writing about trawler men, by writing about, you know, people, men working in a bread factory. It has actually been an allegation that until now he hasn't really tried to write women characters properly, and it obviously shows.
Well, I don't know. I very much enjoyed the character of the young woman in The Godbotherers. You know, she was writing her emails home, and she was a really kind of feisty young woman who
she
I thought
was
a great girl
as well.
Well,
yeah. She was all it was all about Heat magazine and
no comment.
Can I not just ask, you know, whether people weren't moved by some of the juxtapositions in the play? I mean, it'll be a long time before I forget, really. I mean, I thought John Alderton, and we've seen we've seen him in Beckett and various other plays recently, and I think we have to reassess the kind of actor that he is. And England or Britain is so rich in these actors who I was going to say the twilight of their lives, but certainly in the middle time of their lives, suddenly become so deep and rich in their acting. And I just felt that he had thrown himself into that part so beautifully, and it was so, although it's true, his voice, I mean, sometimes I couldn't hear what he was saying, but the sight of the young Eddie humping away and the sight of the older Eddie about to immolate himself, I found truly moving.
I wished that I had been moved. However, I was actually very impressed by a lot of the acting. I think that Jeremy Swift, who plays him as the middle-aged man when he's got his nickname of Tits, I thought he was terribly, terribly good in a very, very unshowy performance. It's just sort of, he's solid, he's rooted. You can actually see how he grew from the cocksure young lad into this sort of entrepreneurial type that's going
desperate.
To mess up.
He was also desperate.
Absolutely.
But there is this problem, though, that it was difficult to understand what the chemistry was between any of these characters, actually. They were all so kind of different and non-communicative, really, in either setting.
I would just like to add a word there for Paul Miller, who actually did the production, because unlike you, I thought it was choreographed beautifully. I mean, I didn't feel that they got in the way of the furniture. I didn't feel that their movements got in the way of the story, and I was very impressed actually by the production.
Just as a final thing, we've talked a lot about the relationship and the personal development of these characters, but he was also trying to work on a social point, and this after all was a play that was on the main stage at the Royal Court. Did you think that it should have been there, and it actually went beyond this portrayal of a marriage in decline?
Well, I think he's trying to make political points about the ravages of time and how that affects your hopes and your dreams and your expectations and the disappointments of a life, or I don't know what the opposite of it is, the appointments of a life. I just don't think that the piece rises much beyond a set of interesting characters, and actually a play like David Eldridge's Under the Blue Sky, which was upstairs at the Royal Court, which Rufus Norris directed in I think about 2000, didn't have the device of the same characters, but it looked at sort of parallel-ish couples, three sets of them in a very similar way, but that was 20 times the play that this was.
But it's also looking about how you drag yourself up from a working class upbringing as well. Patrick, did you feel that came across strongly?
To be honest with you, Rachel, I'm not very well placed to talk about dragging yourself up from a working class background, and it didn't really work for me at all. I didn't see any further themes in it, in the play at all. It did seem to me just to be about these three stages of a relationship, and that was it, and with some good gags along the way.
Jane, did you think it deserved to be at the Royal Court?
Not really. I was just going to say, actually, that I did think when they started talking about the fishing industry and the decline of the fishing industry, that was one of the few times when I was actually engaged.
And Carol?
Well, I think you could certainly raise the issue, is it the kind of play that the Royal Court main stage should be doing at the moment? Has the Royal Court, or has the wonderful Ian Rickson, have they vacated the position of the theatre which is at the cutting edge of new writing? I have no qualms in feeling that actually upstairs in the studio, that is certainly still true, but I have very severe questions to ask about whether it's still happening down in the main theatre.
David, you look as if you've got something to say about this.
I think that the Royal Court's brief is to honour the vision of its writers, and Richard Bean is a Royal Court writer, and this is the next play that he wrote. And if you don't stage writers' plays, terrible things happen to them, because you've got this unborn child. And actually, this is a play that's being done in relation with the English Touring Theatre. It's, you know, it's a commitment that should be honoured, because I mean, even though, as I say, I'm not well-versed in the works of Richard Bean, there are moments of great tenderness in this. He is clearly a writer. This is not, to my mind, a great play, but he is clearly a writer, and that's what the Royal Court should be looking for.
David Benedict, Patrick Marmion, Jane Edwards and Carol Waters, thank you very much.